Two great movies, which Orson Welles directed and starred in, Touch of Evil and Citizen Kane, have been re-released and are playing theatrically in selected cities. Touch of Evil has been re-edited and remixed to closer approximate the vision Welles had before the studio did the final edit. Citizen Kane is widely considered among the best films ever made. Welles plays newspaper publisher Charles Foster Kane. Here's a scene from early in Citizen Kane, where Kane is arguing with his banker, who's angry about an article Kane's paper just published because it indicts the public transit company which the banker and Welles own.
Charles, I think I should remind you of a fact that you seem to have forgotten.
Yes.
That you are yourself one of the largest individual stockholders in the public transit company.
The trouble is you don't realize you're talking to two people. As Charles Foster Kane, who owns 82,364 shares of public transit preferred, you see, I do have a general idea of my holdings. I sympathize with you. Charles Foster Kane is a scoundrel. His paper should be run out of town. A committee should be formed to boycott him. You may, if you can form such a committee, put me down for a contribution of $1,000.
My time's
on the other hand, I am the publisher of the Enquirer. As such, it's my duty, and I'll let you in on a little secret. It's also my pleasure to see to it that decent, hardworking people in this community aren't robbed blind by a pack of money-mad pirates just because they haven't anybody to look after their interests. I'll let you in on another little secret, Mr. Thatcher. I think I'm the man to do it, you see. I have money and property. If I don't look after the interests of the underprivileged, maybe somebody else will.
On this archive edition, we have an interview about Orson Welles with Simon Callow, recorded in 1996, after the publication of the first volume of Callow's biography of Welles. It concludes with the completion of Citizen Kane. Simon Callow is an actor who also wrote an acclaimed book about Charles Laughton. Callow is best known to Americans through his roles as the villain in Ace Ventura, When Nature Calls, the character who is buried in Four Weddings and a Funeral, and the Reverend in A Room with a View. Callow writes that Welles worked hard as a director, but never really pushed himself hard as an actor. Welles simply accepted that he had the temperament and physique to be a leading actor.
He knew that he had certain great natural endowments, a voice the like of which no other actor has had this century, I would say, of commanding physique. You know, he was 6'2" and tremendously broadly built, a very, very powerful, imposing man. And he was very, very intelligent. And he more or less brought these three gifts to his performances. But there was no question of him searching within himself for the character. And there was not terribly much ambition in terms of the actual physical gesture of the character. He had a view that acting essentially consisted of suppressing certain elements of yourself. And in addition, putting on things like noses and various, in fact, large quantities of makeup. The next stage of that, which is an approach favoured by many actors, which is generally to then give in to the thing that you've created. You put on your false nose, you put on your makeup, you look in the mirror, you see somebody else looking back at you, and you start to become that other person. That last bit was the bit Welles resisted. He didn't want that. He wanted to be in control all the time, so that he was on top of the character, as it were, presenting the character to the audience at one remove.
Do you think because his personality was so outsized, he didn't want to make it subservient to the character's personality?
I think that's right. And I think he also had developed this, as you say, outsized personality, and was the last thing he wanted to do was to investigate alternative possibilities of who or what he might have been. This was it. This was the Orson Welles that he wanted to be, and he stuck with it.
You know, I'm a big fan of your earlier biography of Charles Laughton. And as I was telling you before we recorded the interview, a quote of Laughton's that I quite like is Laughton saying, people don't know what they're like, but I think I can show them, which I think beautifully sums up acting at its best. When I mentioned this, my admiration for this quote to you, you said this is something that Orson Welles would never say.
Yes, absolutely.
Why not?
He didn't believe, he didn't think of acting or indeed the theatre as a mirror of human life in the way that Laughton obviously did, and to some extent that Brecht, to whom Laughton made the remark, did. Instead, Welles, I believe, saw it as the telling of big fables, which to some extent, gave a model of human life. But in no sense, I believe, did he think that it was a personal statement or a personal revelation. Whereas Lawton absolutely fed off his own inner life to an extraordinary degree, to an almost morbid degree, but to a degree that meant that his finest performances are piercingly human and disturbing in a way that nothing, I think, that Wells as an actor ever did. This is not that, you must understand, to denounce Wells as an actor. He had many remarkable qualities and was a very exhilarating performer on many occasions. But what Lawton was trying to do, I suspect, was more creative than what Wells was attempting, more creative and more courageous, and in the end cost him more, a price that Wells wasn't prepared to pay or didn't think worth paying.
Now, Wells didn't... Maybe Wells didn't push himself hard as an actor, but he sure seemed to push the actors who he was directing really hard, particularly in Citizen Kane, where he did take after take after take until he felt that it was exactly what he wanted.
Absolutely. When I say he didn't push himself very hard, I mean, he was, frankly, a rather lazy actor. That's in a nutshell, what Wells was. But he did push himself quite far physically sometimes, and... he certainly pushed his actors very far physically. If there was a sequence that involved coordinated action, then Wells would work it and work it and work it. But Wells was by no means of the persuasion of, shall we say, Stanislavski or Harold Clurman or even a Guthrie McClintock. He didn't actually require the actors to delve into themselves. He didn't. He wasn't challenging the truth, as it were. What he was challenging was the physical execution.
Well, he even transformed himself for Citizen Kane. What did he do to make himself the handsome young man that he thought Kane needed to be for the performance?
Yes, Wells was, even as a young man, in a constant struggle with his waistline. And for the early Kane, he, first of all, was taking quite a lot of dietary tablets, which were mostly amphetamines, and he was wearing a fierce corset. And his whole face was pulled back with the use of fish glue. He gave himself, as it were, a face lift with makeup. Maurice Seideman, his makeup artist, devised this incredible sort of cage to pull back, rather in the manner of the later Marlene Dietrich, to pull the whole of the muscular face back. And indeed, he looks pretty dazzling as a result of it. He was very funny about it in later life. Norman Mailer had said of him that he was, at that age, the most beautiful young man who had ever lived. And Wells very self-mockingly said, but it took 5 hours to get it that way.
Right. Do you mind talking about Citizen Kane? Because I know you started off to write about the theater life of Orson Welles, not his film life.
Well, I'm delighted. Nothing pleases me more. After all, the book is called The Road to Xanadu, and Xanadu is where Citizen Kane exists. So the whole point, really, of my... Once I'd changed my idea of writing a biography was just to show how all that early life and all that theatre fed into his work on the screen. And it's fascinating that the cinematographer that he worked with, Greg Toland, favoured long takes and wasn't keen on a fussy cutting technique where you keep cutting away to people.
Well, let me back up a second here. When Orson Welles made Citizen Kane, it was his first movie. He'd just come to Hollywood. He hadn't acted on screen before. He certainly hadn't directed before. And so he had to surround himself with talented people. And one of the people who he worked with was Greg Toland, the cinematographer, who had done what other films? What, Wuthering Heights, Grapes of Wrath?
And most importantly, a film called The Long Voyage Home for John Ford, which is where he began the experiment that he continued with Kane, experimenting with deep focus photography, using ceilings and all of that stuff.
Yeah, explain a little more what this approach to deep focus was and why it was unusual at that time.
Well, the prevailing cinematographic language was one of in which... there was an attempt to distill a kind of pleasing, realistic picture. The idea was to make it look like life. And what Toland favoured was a much more dramatic conception, much more visually charged. So as you could, for example, have a scene in which people were a long way apart from each other, but both was in focus. Whereas normally the sort of lenses and the sort of lighting that was favoured by the mainstream cinematography was to favour the close-up and the foreground figure. So as a background figure would be in soft focus. What it does is to make the dynamic impact of each frame hugely greater. It's quite a shock. Every frame of Citizen Kane punches you between the eyes. That's what Toland thought cinematography should be. Curious enough, he thought that was more realistic than the other approach to cinema. But in fact, we now feel that it's very intensified and indeed somewhat expressionistic, which is really where the techniques evolved in the German cinema of the 20s and 30s and early 30s.
Did Toland's cinematography work well with Wells' experience as a man of the theatre?
Oh, tremendously, because Wells was, you might say, for the most part, he was a sort of expressionist theatre director, and he favoured the extreme contrasts in lighting that is also characteristic of the expressionist cinema, and he used shadows a great deal, which is another very, very common feature of that kind of shooting. And what he strove for in the theatre was exactly what Toland strove for in film, which was maximum expressive impact. So as you were absolutely electrified by the physical production of a Wells show.
You describe Wells as being almost ruthless at rehearsals because he'd rehearse his actor so much and then have him do take after take until he felt the scene was perfect.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about what the rehearsals were like? And what interests you about them as an actor yourself?
You mean the rehearsals for Kane?
For Kane.
Well, first of all, he did a lot of rehearsal, which is quite an unusual thing in film. It was unusual then, as still unusual. He sort of stole time out of the studio schedules by pretending that they were just read-throughs. They were really very clearly and vividly planned and rehearsed before they got in front of the camera. As I said, Toland's cinematography played very well into Wells's theatrical experience because he wasn't interested. One of the first things you have to decide as a director is how you're going to dispose the shots in the scene. How are you going to break it down? So, you know, is the camera going to be on me during my speech and then cut to somebody else? Will we have a wide shot? Will we have a close-up? All that grammar of film is very hard to master. Fortunately, Toland, as I said, favoured rather long takes in which the camera followed the actors. So Wells could stage the thing however he liked, more or less as he would do on a stage in the theatre. And then Toland devised the camera movement, which would follow the run. So there are wonderful sequences, like the party at the Enquirer, in which the camera, it never stops moving and follows everyone. It's a long time before you actually get a cut to anything. And so that terrible anxiety, I speak from experience, since I've directed a movie, and one of the hardest things for me to really come to terms with was the question of the breakdown of the shots. But Wells didn't really have that problem. And indeed, it made it a great deal easier for editing, too, because by and large, the editing was sort of done in the camera. The Robert Wise, who edited it, didn't really have all that much to do. It had all been shot in the camera. Instead of having acres and acres of footage in which you decide, shall I cut away to this or cut away to that? On the contrary, in Kane, the scenes really hold from beginning to end.
Simon Callow, recorded in 1996 after the publication of the first volume of his biography of Orson Welles. Welles' films Touch of Evil and Citizen Kane are back in theaters in selected cities and will be opening in more cities in the next few weeks.